Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a partnership of Prairie Public, the North Dakota Humanities Council, and the University of North Dakota College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us at whyradioshow.org.
What is welfare economics? Are human capabilities a measure of economic well-being? What is the standard of living and how does it relate to justice? Join me, Jack Russell Weinstein, and my guest Amartya Sen for The Other Economics, Welfare, Development, and Justice. Here on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, broadcast live on Prairie Public, right after the news. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Thank you for joining us. Today, we're talking to Amartya Sen, Nobel Prize laureate and professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'll take your calls later at 888-755-6377. That's 888-755-6377. Or if you prefer, email us at askwhy@und.edu. We'd also like to welcome those at the listening parties in Grand Forks, Fargo, and Findlay, North Dakota, and our first in Portland, Oregon. Welcome, everyone, and we're glad to have you here. As Y increases its exposure, especially outside the state, I find myself being asked the same question again and again. How often do you present topics of interest to North Dakotans? This, I think, is a rather telling question, indicative of the complex relationships North Dakotans have with, well, everybody else. It demands investigation into what we can call the philosophy of North Dakota. Who are we and what do we want? How are we different from others and how are we the same? The question about topics that interest North Dakotans is actually in code. It has something to do with rural life, with feeling like outsiders, with being multi-generational residents, steadfastly holding on to a very specific history, but not really. It's also about being labeled as a red or a flyover state, but that's not it either, especially since North Dakotans get furious when they are depicted as stereotypes. Last year, National Geographic published an article called The Emptied Prairie, which argued that the state was emptying, dying, a remnant of a once energetic past, and the furor in the state was overwhelming. Collectively, we were insulted, even more so when the response from the magazine was that we had to get over it. Yet the article feels like a logical extension of how North Dakotans sometimes portray ourselves as opposed to what we really think ourselves to be. This public posture seems more pronounced in North Dakota than many places I have lived. It's also increasingly inaccurate. Our population is on the rise, not in decline. One-third of North Dakotans live in cities. And while there are plenty of farmers, most people live in towns with grids, downtown schools, and shops. They have neighbors a few yards away. As for the red state thing, while we've gone for a Republican president for what seems to be forever, close to half the population voted for Obama in 2008, and we've had a completely Democratic congressional delegation for years. Part of what makes North Dakota so interesting is that it is so complicated. We are not one thing. So what is it that people are asking me when they ask about topics for North Dakotans? They claim to be asking if there will be shows about hunting and sports, if our guests will be regular folk who live down the street. But what they're really asking is whether the show will make them feel dumb and invisible, which is exactly how National Geographic made the whole state feel. Hey, we said, there are all these people, all these businesses, there's all this life. We're standing right in front of you. Why can't you see us? But this is just not a North Dakotan experience. It's a human one, one that Amartya Sen reports on in his research. No one likes to feel dumb, and people hate being invisible. People want acknowledgement, recognition, validation. Can a radio show provide all that? Well, yes and no. Philosophy is a funny thing. It conjures up images of old men in togas and abstract arguing with no end in sight. But Y is committed to the idea that everyone does philosophy every day. They may not do it professionally or question things with the kind of discipline that Plato would have preferred, but they're still doing it. Philosophy is the space we use to ask questions that direct our lives and frame our beliefs, to examine assumptions that don't always get our attention but are with us whatever we do. When I play a pickup game of basketball in the schoolyard, no matter how badly I play, I'm still playing basketball. Yet some people insist that philosophy is something narrow, specific, and unprofessionalized when non-philosophers do it. philosophers want to pretend that North Dakotans don't do philosophy, just as North Dakotans want to pretend they don't. Frankly, I don't understand either position. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, the founding document of modern capitalism, argued that the free market would turn activities into specializations, philosophy included. We'll talk a bit about Smith today. But while specialists work in niches, amateurs explore wide ranges of things. That's the fun in being an amateur. And while no one expects non-philosophers to write treatises or read classical Greek, each person is expected to vote and have opinions on moral issues, to raise their children well and be good neighbors. Deliberations about how we do these things involve philosophy. So the short answer to whether our topics are North Dakotan is that North Dakotans are interested in examining universal health care and justice as much as anyone else. But the more complicated answer is that North Dakotans, like others, need to examine the relationship between our particular situation and the whole world that we live in. We have to know about Amartya Sen's India just as Indians ought to know about North Dakota. Knowledge benefits everyone, and it is what economists call a non-rival good. It doesn't go away when someone else's use it. An inquiry is not a zero-sum affair. The more people are involved, the more we learn. Discoveries are discoveries about the world, about everyone, and they reveal not just local facts, but hopefully universal truths. Amartya Sen's exploration of welfare economics is an ideal example of how philosophy is about the human experience, and North Dakotans are just as human as anyone else. So today on Why, we will engage these human questions with Amartya Sen, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University, and author of numerous books, some of which are titled Ethics and Economics, The Standard of Living, Development as Freedom, and most recently, The Idea of Justice. If you'd like to join in the conversation, write us via email at askwhy@und.edu, that's ask W-H-Y, or call later in the show at 888-755-6377. Amartya, thanks for joining us here on Why.
Thank you very much for having me.
As a professor of both economics and philosophy, the first question that I have to ask is, what do the two subjects have to do with each other?
Oh, a great deal. Philosophy is really about knowing the world and knowing also how our own mind works, how we reason, how we understand each other, how we communicate. And economics as a social science is concerned with both understanding the world and our relations with each other. But also, when we, in philosophy, when we are concerned with knowing the world, part of that world, of course, the economic world. No, I don't really think that there is a kind of dilemma or a dichotomy there. Philosophy and economics relate quite closely with each other. That's not the only thing interesting about philosophy or only thing interesting about economics, but I don't think we can treat them as two kind of divergent streams that never meet.
We've already received almost a dozen questions in advance for you, and one of them, Sudipita, wrote through Facebook that there is some question as to whether your contributions, and we'll talk specifically about them as time goes on, are more philosophical or more economic. Do you think of them as one way or the other, or do you think of them as overlapping?
Jack, that is a very complicated question.
You know, I specialize
I've lived,
in those.
Well, because I've lived a long life and I've written in many different subjects. I've written in economics and written in philosophy, and my economic writings have been more concerned with economics, and that includes, causes of famines and analysis of hunger. It also includes how we can measure the nature of economic progress that's taking place in a country or in the world, whether global trade hurts us or helps us and so on. These are economic questions. But I've also been concerned with such issues as the foundations of ethics and also questions of epistemology. How do we know what the world is like, given the fact that we are always at a given position? Anything that we see is conditional on where we are vis-à-vis the rest of the world. How do we form a view about the world while we stand at a particular spot on the world and not somewhere else from where the world may look very different? So I think when I have tried to tackle philosophical questions, I think there have been exercises in philosophy. The questions in economics have been similarly concerned with that subject. I don't think that's very remarkable. You know, there's no obligation to work only in one subject in one's life, actually. And if you particularly take the view that you have one human life to lead, I think the temptation to do a bit more than just one subject is very strong.
It is very interesting to watch people who have had lengthy careers and how much they want to branch out in other areas. And one of the things that we see in your work is you make this distinction between predictive and welfare economics. And many of our listeners are largely exposed to the predictive end. What is this distinction and why is this an essential way of understanding different aspects of the discipline?
Yeah, I think, Jack, it is a distinction rather than a dichotomy. It's a distinction in the sense prediction is concerned with what would happen if I did something differently. If, for example, we raised the taxes or if we were to, when we bailed out, when the United States government bailed out the financial sector of the country, whether that would create confidence in the market, whether that will create jobs and sufficiently fast. These are all predictive questions. But then there's the issue about whether this is the right thing to do. Now, they're not a dichotomy because you can't begin to judge whether it's the right thing to do without making first the predictions as to what would actually happen. But then there's an issue that takes us beyond that. You might say, well, I mean, let's take the U.S. situation right now, where in some sense, the recession is over in terms of the crisis of the stock market, which is to a great extent been reversed. The confidence of return in the financial sector, I would argue not fully, and I think it's overestimated, but by and large, I accept the story that there is truth in that. And yet the number of unemployed people in the United States is steadily increasing and has been so and now recently crossed the 10% mark. Now, if we were to judge whether we are heading the right direction, we have to first see that is it the case that the unemployment problem is best tackled in a way that concerned first with the economy and with the financial sector, and once the confidence returns, that the unemployment will start to go down. That's clearly the view that the administration has taken. People could dispute that, and that disputation will have some content about predictive differences. But then even if we agree on that, one might say, well, there could have been other methods whereby unemployment could have been reduced more quickly, and even at the cost of the financial sector remaining a little less secure for a while, would it not have been better? Now, these are questions of ethics. I mean, I'm just taking an example of economic ethics, but of course we face, I think not the courts face not only predictive economics, but ethical questions all the time. Whether it's in economics, they would have views about taxes, they would have views about agricultural pricing, they would have views about unemployment, how tolerable or intolerable it is. And these are all ethical questions. So I should imagine that as a part of humanity, we all are interested both in making predictive, to have some predictive understanding, as well as making ethical judgments of one kind or another. They're not unrelated, but they're distinct.
One of the places that we see the overlap between predictive and ethical concerns are in your discussion of quality of life and standard of living. So when we return from the break, we're going to put those questions on center stage and ask what exactly we mean by quality of life. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Amartya Sen on Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Prairie Public, a news information and music service in partnership with the University of North Dakota and North Dakota State University.
You're listening to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking to Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate and professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University. Give us a call at 1-888-755-6377 if you'd like to participate in the conversation, or write us at askwhy@und.edu. Amartya, once again, thank you. What is the standard of living, and why is it valuable for economics?
Well, the standard of living at its very basic level is some kind of a general idea of how well the lives of people are going as far as material and particularly economic considerations could make a change to one's life. So it's concerned with whether people are happy or unhappy, but not for every reason. I mean, if I write poetry and nobody likes my poetry, I might be very unhappy, but it couldn't be said that my standard of living is low. On the other hand, if I write good poetry and people like it, but nevertheless I happen to be hungry or happen to suffer from illnesses for which I cannot afford to pay for the cure or treatment, when I'm limited by economic means, the kind of unhappiness that would come from it would be related to the idea of living standard. Now, I've used the word happiness, but I'm using it very generally. Sometimes our discontent is concerned not so much with a sense of unhappiness, pleasure or lack of pleasure or pain, but maybe connected with a sense of frustration, lack of freedom, that we can't do this, we can't do that, we have so little choice. You know, one of the early studies I remember when I was working on my attempt to take a different approach to standard of living was a study of the Belgian unemployed in Europe. And one of the striking things was that the study indicated that people were concerned not only with the fact that they can't buy the kind of clothes and housing, etc., which they would like to have, but also they don't have freedom to do many things. They're afraid of resigning from a job, even if they're very dissatisfied, they're afraid, so afraid of not finding another, that there is an unfreedom. And they regarded that to be a kind of limitation of their life. So living standard could be low in a variety of ways, connected with our material prosperity, our ability to afford things, and so on. And quality of life is the kind of life that we can enjoy based on that. And it's something that interests us all. I mean, it's not the only thing that interests us. To come back to my old example, if I were to write poetry, which happily I don't, but if I were to do it, I would quite like people to enjoy it. But that's a different kind of complaint, that I like poetry, but people don't like my poetry. And that would be a source of discontent, but a very different kind. So quality of life separates out those things, which are kind of generic concern that we all have about the kind of basically the freedoms and prosperity of our normal lives.
When you talk about you're writing poetry and people not liking it, one of the realities of human experience is that you can't control people's reactions to things. And yet you use the term freedom many times. I know this is a simple question to answer, but what is freedom?
Well, it's not a simple question to answer, Jack. If you think that's a simple question, then...
I just like to catch you off guard, remind you that it's a live show.
You certainly have done that. No, I think basically freedom is our ability to do things that we value doing, or be things that we value being. Doing would be an example, supposing I want to be able to go out of my house and go and see a movie, or a play, or go and have a reasonable meal, go and see friends somewhere for which I might need locomotion, like a car or some kind of transport arrangement. If I'm able to do it, then I have the freedom to do that, and if I'm not able to do it, then I don't have the freedom to do it. Similarly, some of these are not active doing it, need not be particularly athletic. achievements that we value, like being well nourished, not suffering from vitamin deficiencies or not suffering from ailments of one kind or another. So these are concerns about what we can be or what we can do, and freedom is our ability to do it, whether or not we actually do it. I mean, just to make the distinction, when to refer to a countryman of mine, when Mahatma Gandhi was fasting as a protest against the iniquities of the British imperial rule, he had the freedom to eat because he certainly had the means to do so, but he was still fasting because he chose to fast. He was making a point. Similarly, lots of people fast for religious reasons. Lots of people deny themselves many things which they're able to do. Now, the freedom is not concerned with whether you're denying yourself or not, but whether if you chose to do it, that you could actually do it. So it's that we're trying to capture. Freedom could be defined in 100 different ways, and I think it's Cooper who had this lovely poem that freedom has 100 charms to show, or 1,000 charms to show, I think, which slaves will never know. I think it had many, many, many different aspects, but I think what I'm trying to capture particularly is the one which I tried to describe to you, Jack.
You talk about this distinction between being and doing. And we just received a question from Troy from Bismarck, who asks, how does the nature of the mind relate to economic stability? And this question connects directly to your work on the capabilities and human capabilities as related to standard of living. What is it about the capabilities that has such importance in your economic system? And why is the development of human capabilities so essential to not only human freedom, as you were talking about, but the standard of living and quality of life?
Jack, that is a very good, but also a very difficult question, but let me try to answer it. The idea of capability is really closely related to the idea of freedom, and in one form or another, it actually goes back to the writings of Aristotle, at least in the Western culture, that is, in this case. In ancient Greek thinking, I can think of similar discussion in the Indian and other non-Western contexts. When, for example, Gautam Buddha, I think I recognize that in English or American it's pronounced as Buddha, but I was pronouncing it as I think he was known, namely Buddha, who was the founder of Buddhism. When he left home in a state of disturbance and discontent, he was struck by the fact that he saw a very ill person who couldn't help being in agony. Another day he saw a very disabled person, disabled in that case by old age. And in another case he saw a person who was dead and who couldn't prevent his death. And so he was concerned as to how limited our capabilities are in the world context. And then he developed, of course, a theory about the nature of society as well as beyond our lives. Now, I've been particularly involved with what we see in the society. And the capability idea is concerned with the freedom that we actually have in the life that we happen to live. And that includes, of course, longevity and freedom from premature mortality or morbidity that could be avoided. I think the reason why it's important is that the alternative, which has been very standard in economic analysis, namely the Benthamite analysis based on pleasure and happiness, is a very defective scale. And, I spent a lot of my time, Jack, in the 1970s, for more than a decade, working on the causes of famine. And that was mainly in economics work. But I was very struck by the fact also that when you're traveling around very famine-stricken people, when they manage to eventually get a meal, the level of happiness that these poor creatures have is unbelievably more than I've ever seen any rich person actually have. Because there is a kind of absolute sense of triumph after fasting or starving for a week to find at last some food to eat, and it tastes great, and life is fantastic. If you measure it in the scale of happiness, you might decide that that person who is enjoying that meal after starving involuntarily for a week is having the biggest living standard or highest achievement that anyone could have. But that would be a mistake. The person is still bothered by where would the next meal come from. And so, and the capability to be nourished and have regular meals and be sheltered, to well clothed and so on, are important capability. So I think the scale of happiness could be very deceptive. I mean, when you're dealing with people who are very used to deprivation, precarious lives, landless laborers in many countries, most people in agriculture, or many people in agriculture, unlike in North Dakota, but in the rest of the world, often don't own any land, but they cultivate, and they have no security of tenure there either. And they could be very precarious lives. And nevertheless, if you are completely used to that, that's the only life you know. Or if you're a woman who live in a sexist society, you've got used to the fact that women don't enjoy the rights that men do, you may come to terms with it. And this may not constantly, your disadvantage may not reveal itself in your sense of pain or your even a perception that you're suffering all the time. You just get so used to it, and therefore to judge people's disadvantage and deprivation in terms of psychology is a defective measure, because psychology is a very bendable scale. People get adapted to deprivation, and I wanted something which is a bit more objective than that. And I think in the writings of Aristotle, and particularly writings of Adam Smith, to whom we have already referred, in my case that came to a great extent from my early reading of Adam Smith, that it makes a huge difference whether a person have the ability to do this and do that, and not whether he's enjoying and getting pleasure from whatever abilities he happens to have. I think whether or not you actually have the ability, actually have the freedom, is important. And I think since economics was not considering it, I think Adam Smith did, but that was 250 years ago, it seemed to me to be very important to emphasize that. That was my main motivation.
When we get back from the next break, I want to talk specifically about Adam Smith. I want to talk about the division between his two books and how you and others, myself included, have worked very hard to see how the two works are related and why that is important to contemporary economics and philosophy of economics in general. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Amartya Sen on Prairie Public, and we'll be back shortly.
The next installment in the Art and Democracy film series is the classic Stanley Kubrick film, Dr. Strangelove. Join Y and the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life for this free movie and discussion at the Empire Theater in Grand Forks. That's the night before Thanksgiving on Wednesday, November 25th at 7 p.m. It's free. Bring your friends. Next month, Y asks, "What is critical thinking?" with guest Harvey Siegel, Chair of the Philosophy Department at the University of Miami. As always, we broadcast at 5 p.m. Central on the second Sunday of the month. Join us on December 13th for an in-depth look at human reason and our ability to critically examine our own beliefs. Visit the Y Radio store to purchase mugs, t-shirts, and show your support for Y. Click on the store link at www.yradioshow.org. While you're there, check out the schedule for the coming season, our archives, and subscribe to our podcast. That's WHYRadioshow.org.
You're listening to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate and professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard, about the other economics, welfare and justice. Give us a call at 888-755-6377 if you'd like to participate in the conversation. That's 888-755-6377. Or write us at askwhy@und.edu. Amartya, when we're talking before the break, you brought up Adam Smith a couple times.
Yes.
Adam Smith wrote two different books, among having two sets of lectures. One, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which was written first about moral psychology and ethical life, and then The Wealth of Nations, which became famous as a founding document in what will eventually be modern economics. People think of these two books as separate, yet you and others argue that they're interrelated. Why is that so important?
Well, Jack, I think it is important, and you know, you yourself, of course, have written on that subject. It's important because Adam Smith was a very integrated personality, and the idea that he wrote two books which were completely disconnected, I mean, there would be nothing wrong, I mean, in a very tiny way, without trying to compare myself with anyone as great as Adam Smith. I mean, many of my writings are quite disparate, but I think the trouble really is that a lot of people not only took that to be separate, Adam Smith's moral theory or moral sentiment, published in 1759 exactly, 2.5 centuries ago, quarter of a millennium ago, and the second book, 1776, a memorable day in the U.S. history for a different reason, when the Adam Smith Wealth of Nations came out. Very often people have put these against a kind of horse race against each other, as if they're competing for attention, theory of moral sentiments emphasizing how people have goodwill towards each other, and the Wealth of Nations arguing for self-centered individuals trying to pursue their own gain and in the process making the world a better place. There's a kind of two different philosophies as if they're in tension with each other. Well, those two philosophies would be in tension with each other, but neither of those philosophies are Smith's. Smith did think that human beings have a complexity of motivation, some of which are concerned with self-interest, quite a lot of it is concerned with deep sympathy for each other. Indeed, we can't begin to view humanity in its fullness without making room for each of these motivations. So I think the first reason for my being concerned with this question is to correct what seems to me to be a perceptual error. But secondly, a lot of the Wealth of Nations, which was written later, draws on what Smith thought he had already discussed in the Theory of Moral Sentiment. Indeed, in the Theory of Moral Sentiment, he mentioned that there are things to be done about how these ideas relate to particular economic and social spheres. And the book was published in 1759, when the last edition came out in 1790, shortly before his death, Smith recognized that the promise that he had made earlier was to some extent now realized through the work that he had done in The Wealth of Nations. So he took the work to be highly complementary to each other, and there are passages in The Wealth of Nations which we can't begin to follow without bringing in what he thinks, rightly, he has already discussed in The Moral Sentiment. And I think I had the privilege of writing the introduction to an anniversary edition, 250th anniversary edition, that Penguin Books is producing of the Theory of Moral Sentiment. I spent a lot of time seeing and discussing how these two books relate to each other and how you can get a view of Smith that is much fuller if you take the two together. I mean, that to a great extent is an issue that has engaged you as well, Jack, if I'm not mistaken.
The division, though, between the Theory of Moral Sentiments and the Wealth of Nations, that debate is also a bit about libertarianism, isn't it, and laissez-faire economic structures. To what extent is the battle about Adam Smith really the battle about how economics is to govern our society and our world?
Yes, I think the argument for people being left alone, and they will do a lot of good things, and the perspective that people need each other's help to be able to be able to do good things. Both these figure and Smith, and it could be thought that they are not contradictory with each other, but they are in some ways complementary to each other. But I would not like to see them, Jack, as a conflict between the two books, because both these ideas occur in each of the books. And in the, if you take the Smith's more well-known work, namely The Wealth of Nations, which, as you rightly said, Jack, had transformed modern economics. Smith is really regarded as the father of modern economics on grounds of his authorship of the Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. So if you take that view, you'll find, if you take that book, you'll find both the points of view. At one stage, when Smith is very critical of the way individual initiatives are stifled by completely stupid taxes which prevent people from doing, like importing commodities from another country, agricultural goods being exported from one country to another, and other restrictions, he is pointing out that by restricting human freedom, you're actually not only hurting the guy in question whose freedom is restricted, but also the economy and the rest of the lives of the humanity involved. But he also discusses that how the market economy, unrestricted, could lead to a situation which is dominated by speculators who can make quick money or who expect to make quick money and then get out of the business. And indeed, there's something extraordinarily contemporary in discussing the in reading those bits of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which deal with that question. He has a passage dealing with people he describes as prodigals and projectors. And these are quite a good description of some of the architects of the present-day crisis today, including the subprime lending entrepreneurs who could persuade borrowers to take completely stupid risk. And then by using financial transactions, get out of the market themselves, having made some profit. Now, the prodigal projector description that Smith has from 1776 fits the story today extremely well. But these are both in The Wealth of Nations. On one side, he's being critical of the state overreaching itself. On the other side, he wants the state to do something. He, for example, he thought that in the case of prodigals and projectors, the state had the duty to intervene and to protect, to regulate. It's something that is not in tension with the other part of Smith, where the counterproductive restrictions by the state are being criticized. But we have to see Smith fully to understand that that's what he is arguing for, namely the state has a role. The market doesn't stand alone as a freestanding instrument, and yet the market needs its own space. So he believed in a multi-institution structure. He also wanted institutions for the support of poor people. Unlike, say, Robert Malthus, he was not opposed to the idea of supporting the poor through the poor laws of his time. He thought that the poor laws was just too restrictive on human freedom. They did not violate, they supported the poor. You lose your support if you move up out of your country and went somewhere else. And he wanted a more humane system. And in many ways, he argued for institutions, including state institutions. He also argued for the market, which he saw as one institution of profoundly important.
This debate about the market and the institutions is a debate that we feel very much now in the question of universal health care and what's on the table. We actually have a phone call from Ron in Minot who wants to connect our discussion to this health care. Ron, welcome to Why.
Well, thank you. Well, you may have already answered my question, the last comments were pertinent. You know, I'm looking at the self-interest, and when politics is part of that, the laws are going to, because of self-interest, benefit those who have the money and the power. So, you know, thinking about the state of North Dakota as an analogy to the health care, the railroad rates here, there's a monopoly in North Dakota because the railroad could set the rates. That was finally opposed by farmers' leagues, farmers' co-ops, who got some state regulation on the monopoly. They were charging outrageous rates. The same now is with the healthcare industry, that this has been an unregulated insurance industry. It's been left to the states, although the insurance industry crosses, as a trade unit, crosses state boundaries. It's been kind of legally, and what has happened is we have monopolies like Blue Shield Blue Cross in North Dakota, who run 80% of the health insurance in the state, and yet it's unregulated federally, unregulated really by the state, so they kind of monopolize and set rates. So I'm looking at that. Where does the state come in when it comes to, you know, institutions like health insurance?
Well, I think that's your name is Ron, isn't it? I didn't.
Yes, it's Ron.
Right? Ron. Yes. Ron, now that's an excellent question. And, you know, I think there are two things to say on that. One is that clearly the state has a role in regulations. One has to be careful that it does not stifle competition. At the same time, you need protection, you need regulation in order to prevent the rest of us from the activities of prodigals and projectors, as Smith called them. And so he felt no sense of tension about this. So that's the second point to make, that not only is it sensible to have regulation without killing the golden goose that's laying the eggs, namely a market economy that thrives on competition, but there is a complementarity, because the market economy can remain more competitive, as I think your example itself was, that by imposing restrictions on monopoly, which is the state restrictions, and this country has quite a long history, the United States has, and from what you said, North Dakota has too, in introducing regulations which are supportive of competition and against monopoly. But in supporting competition, and therefore supporting competitive market, you also need state to execute that. And those arguments actually figure, in the case of Smith, in terms of the financial markets, about how the interest rate may go beyond the reach of people because of competition that's restricted, but where the dominant influence happened to be the speculators who can make quick buck and who can offer interest rate that make normal house owners and others find it very difficult to afford that. So I think it's an issue that goes back a long time. But, you know, I must say I've never particularly seen why this has been made into such a big thing. That is, the idea that the market economy does a lot of good things is very important to understand. But once one understands it, one also wants to see under what circumstances the market would work best. You need one of the things Smith discusses, for a market economy to work, you need an educated labor force, and you may not get private education covering primary education for all. You need the state to come into it. You need the state in all kinds of ways. At his time, already in the 18th century, and I think the needs are much more strongly felt now, since we feel that there are certain basic rights that human beings should have, including rights to pension, rights to be supported if you are unemployed and if you are ill, getting medical care. I think all these things are very much in Smith's line of reasoning, even though in his 18th century world, he discussed some of them much more detailed, like education, than others, like healthcare. On the other hand, it's quite clear that the general idea that you could have a flourishing market economy and at the same time good state intervention that helps rather than hinders, I think that's a very basic idea in Smith. And I don't see any tension there, and there's something really important to learn from it even today.
Amartya, we have about 3 minutes left, and I want to talk briefly about your new book, The Idea of Justice.
Yes.
In particular, because this book is a direct response to theories of justice that dominate in philosophy today, John Rawls most especially. And the thing for me that was the most, I think, powerful in the book was your rejection of an ideal conception of justice and your argument that both Smith and yourself argue for a comparative conception of justice. In just a couple minutes, can you talk a little bit about that and why you've decided to focus on these questions and the comparative justice in particular?
Well, I think there are three reasons. One is that if you go into the question of what would an ideally just society look like, it's a very fascinating question, but on the other hand, it has almost no relevance to anything we are looking at now. I mean, when people were agitating about evolution of slavery, like Abraham Lincoln might have been, or was, or reversing the subjugation of women, as John Stuart Mill was arguing for, they didn't think that the world would become perfectly just if you abolish them, these things. They thought that the world would be less unjust. They're all comparative questions. So the issue of perfect justice is really very, very theoretical. Secondly, we may not have an agreement as to what a perfectly just world would look like. Some of us might think that basic liberties require greater value than others, and others might think that economic equality has a greater value too, and I'm tempted by both the positions. But we don't have to resolve that in order to agree that slavery is unacceptable. People dying without medical care is unacceptable, that people remaining illiterate because there are no schools around, as happens in many parts of the world, is unacceptable. And for that, we don't have to actually agree. So it's not only a luxury, but it's also not necessary in any sense at all. And finally, I think the exercise of what is a perfectly just world has been, since it's intellectually fascinating, has been so diverting to the attention of philosophers that we, and if I may put on the hat of philosophy rather than economics, just for this sentence, that we philosophers have often really not engaged the kind of exercise in which philosophical thoughts are hugely important, namely how to judge whether a change of one kind would increase justice or increase injustice. What will it do? Smith was deeply concerned with the question. So I take my leaf of my book from Smith and Mill and others, Mary Wollstonecraft, for example, but and not so much from Hobbes and Kant and Rousseau and Locke and, in our time, from John Rawls in this respect.
So, unfortunately, we're at the end. Amartya Sen has agreed, and we're happy that he has done this, to have a conversation after the show. So if you're listening to the podcast, stay after the credits, and we'll ask a bunch of the questions that we haven't actually had a chance to ask that we've gotten via email. But for those of you who are leaving us, Amartya Sen, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the chance.
It is a wonderful occasion for us to have such a learned and sophisticated and influential person on our show. And in North Dakota, we sometimes forget that we have things to say to them and that they have things to say to us. We feel apart from the rest of the world more, I think, than we should. And one of the goals of Why is to connect the conversation. When we look back at the discussion that we've had today, we see a couple key issues in how we're supposed to think about the world. Amartya Sen was insistent that there is no disciplinary dichotomy, that economics and philosophy are not fundamentally separate from one another, that they overlap, and that when you're asking economic questions, you're asking philosophical questions. And when you're asking philosophical questions, sometimes you're asking economic questions. And this view is really important, especially when we debate about the role of the free market, about the role of GDP, about the place of economics and healthcare, that when we make economic decisions, we are making philosophical claims and we are expressing our philosophical commitments. In particular, when we talk about these things, we talk about both the freedom to be and the freedom to do. And when we ask about these two things, we have to ask not only what do we have, what do we possess, But what can we do? What are our capacities? What are our capabilities? What are we able to do given the opportunity to do these things? Questions of healthcare, questions of education, questions of government intervention. These are all related to what we are allowed to do and what we can do when we are given the permission to do it. Freedom means nothing, or rather permission means nothing, if we don't have the freedom or the capacity to pursue what we want. Sen was also very clear that the debate about Adam Smith is really the debate about our contemporary world, and that the philosophical foundations of our discussions are incredibly important. Contemporary philosophy is relevant. What we look at for justice, how we examine justice, is incredibly important, and the history of philosophy is important because, and I say this as a Smith scholar myself, where Smith goes, our economy goes. Where our vision of how self-interest and concern for others, how banking regulation or economic regulation and free market, how all those things relate, is going to help define how we see society and how we solve the problems of the world. Professor Sen has been focused on many different questions in many different parts of the world, and there's so much that we haven't talked about today. His discussion of missing women, his focus on famine, his explorations of India, both the poor and the wealthy in India. And I urge everyone to look at his work and to look at the other economics, not simply the predictive economics, but also the questions of welfare and how they relate to one another, how we ask the question of how are we doing, not just in terms of how many televisions we own and not just in terms of what the next quarter will look like, but what are our capacities? What is our way of life? What can we as human beings do when we have the opportunity to do those things? My name is Jack Russell Weinstein. You're listening to Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life here on Prairie Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next month.
Why will return next month when our guest Harvey Siegel will help answer the question, what is critical thinking? Join us on Sunday, December 13th at 5 p.m. here on Prairie Public or at our website at www.whyradioshow.org. Skip Wood is our producer and Chelsea Stone is our intern. Why's music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Why is broadcast on the second Sunday of every month. It is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, the North Dakota Humanities Council, and the University of North Dakota College of Arts and Sciences. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we have inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.
So, Amartya, again, thank you so much for the conversation. We have six questions. The first question, Shannon from Grand Forks, she's read a book called The Third Ways by Alan Carson, and that argued for about economic systems other than capitalism and socialism, and it argued that men should work and that women should stay at home raising the family. She thinks that's economically inviolable, but she defers to you and asks what you think about that as a sort of basic starting economic structure.
Her name is Shannon?
Shannon.
Shannon.
Yes.
Shannon. I think Shannon is right that it's inviolable, but I think it's even before that, it's outrageous, of course, because it's someone laying down the line that men have to do certain things and women have to do their thing. We've been talking about freedom, and of course, it's for women to determine whether they want to stay at home and do those things or do what men do. And they might be much better at it in some occasion than men are. And similarly, men might take a different view as well. So if you're, the first point to make, Shannon, is that before the question of viability comes in, it's quite an outrageous, supposing it were viable, that you could live like that. It would be a pretty nasty life to lead where nobody had freedom to choose something other than what Mr. Carson, is that the name of the gentleman who has written it up? First of all, I would vote against Mr. Carson. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that, yes, you're right, Sir Shannon, it's probably unviable for two different reasons. One is that, you know, that kind of compartmentalization is actually, as it happened, aside from being outrageous, is also pretty inefficient. Because people have to do many things. I mean, you know, that if you're at home and doing housework and looking after children, you still may have to go out and do something for the kids, do some shopping. Sometimes when your husband's income is limited, you may have to go and earn a bit more in order to make life comfortable. And if those things are denied, you're not only denying human freedom, you're also removing certain instruments that are available in an economy to deal with problems like shortages and deficiencies that can be dealt with by crossing the boundaries that Mr. Carlson had laid up. But the second reason is that that freedom is not only something that we can abstractly value, but also something which we concretely value in life, and people would rebel. And it's not, I mean, women's liberation may have become important only very recently, and I might say that even though I am a man myself, I've been always very sympathetic. Indeed, I was one of the founders of the magazine called Feminist Economics, and I don't see any contradiction the fact that I'm distinctly male, that I take a great interest in it. But we take an interest in each other's lives, and if women wanted to do things outside, to keep them restricted, would be increasingly a costly, not only nasty, but also a highly expensive thing. You'd need to construct a kind of prison to keep women in, and a kind of outside, a kind of lockout to keep men out. I don't think you could have a viable economy based on that. So firstly, it's outrageous and unjust and nasty. Secondly, on top of that, it probably is unviable. Now, unfortunately, the problem arises when things are viable, but they are very nasty and unjust. In this case, it's both unjust and unviable. And so I think you are right to be skeptical of Mr. Carson's thesis, at least to the extent I've heard. I shouldn't really comment since I haven't read Mr. Carson's book, but on the basis of what you say, Shannon. There are some cases when things are viable. I mean, slavery was viable for a long, long time. The subjugation of women, not so much the division of role about which Mr. Carson speaks, but not allowing women a voice on certain subjects, they may survive thousands of years in a viable state, and they may still be extremely unjust. So I want to emphasize there are two different questions we have to ask. Is it acceptable? Is it okay? Is it just? Is it a plausible society? Is it ethically okay? And the other question is, can it work? Your question, is it viable? Is it sustainable? And I think they're distinct questions, but in this case, the answer to Mr. Carson's, as I understand Mr. Carson's thesis, seems to be no and a no.
This your answer really emphasizes, I think, what we were talking about, which is the connections between philosophy and economics and the way they relate to one another. And this relates to another question. Tibor from Orange, California, asks, if the right to liberty is fundamental and pre-political, why are other rights such as property not? And obviously, I'd hope to ask this question when we talked a little bit about libertarianism, but the conversation didn't go that way.
No. I think, but it's a very good question that Tibor is asking, like Shannon's question, very important. I think the two things to say there. First of all, that rights as such are difficult to think of them as being pre-political, because in some ways politics is the way we relate with each other. If there may be, we may have a conception of right even before a state is established. and the state comes in and the laws are devised in order to make these rights realizable. But that's still politics, because how we relate to each other is a matter of politics. But I think what Tibor is trying to say, and I think saying it well, is that in some sense there's some distinction between right to liberty and right to property. Right to liberty is seen as something which is connected with our lives, our freedoms, and something which is absolutely immediate to our notion of what it is like to be a human being, to have the freedom to speak, to have the freedom. I mean, after all, we end up with speech in a way that many animals are not, most animals are not. We are allowed, we can move around, we can cogitate, we can congregate, we can scrutinize. And if these liberties are denied, you're interfering with human life directly. Property is different. Property, in some ways, is would be extreme, maybe very important for our life. But if I'm denied of speech, it's a denial of my life. In a way that if you deny my automobile, it's not. Now I might resist my automobile being taken away, and certainly I would have good reason to resist that. On the other hand, I resist it by saying that that the car is important for my life. It's not that it is a part of my life. My car is not a part of my life, unlike my speech, which is a part of my life. There's a distinction. So I think basically those who have emphasized personal liberty as something which is distinct from external rights like rights of ownership of property have tended to play this up, and that distinction. And I think I'm sympathetic to that. John Rawls, to whom I think you referred, Jack, earlier, and the greatest modern philosopher, moral philosopher and political philosopher of our time, even though I happen to disagree with him. On this particular point, I actually agree with him.
Agreement so rarely has anything to do with it in philosophy.
Well, it's sometimes sad, but in this occasion, I actually happen to agree with him. And I don't quite agree with another person who is also a very close friend of mine. I miss both of them very much, Rawls being one and Robert Nozick being other. With whom for 10 years I taught drawing classes in Harvard.
And you speak so eloquently. You speak so eloquently about both of them in the new book. It's very moving.
Yeah, well, they were both close friends, and I disagree with both of them ultimately, but disagree more strongly with Bob Nozick. But Bob Nozick, of course, was in some ways, since he and I taught course together, we dined together like three times a week. Very close friend, but he would have taken the view that the rights to ownership of property is just like right to speech and right to personal liberty, you know, privacy and so on. I didn't agree with him, and that didn't prevent us from being close friends. I can see what the argument on the other side is, but I've tried to present to Tibor what I think is the right argument on my side, namely that there is a distinction, that is our personal life. Freedom in them is different from freedom that emanates from our ownership and external possession that we may happen to have. It's not like having an arm. My car is not like an arm. My tongue is not like my refrigerator, and so on. I think that distinction is to many people important. Certainly, it has figured again and again in both European thought as well as in Indian, sometimes Chinese and Japanese thought, and Middle Eastern thought too. So I think there is a distinction here.
Okay, I know that both of our engineers may have some pressure, so I want to combine a couple questions, because we had some questions about your work on famine. And how you feel, first, do you agree with people like Norman Borlaug that overpopulation isn't really a concern, that we can deal with that? And what do you also you think about the place of corruption in dealing with famine and all those sorts of things? And then related to that is Phil from Fort Collins is asking, does global climate change suggest that economic systems have grown too large, and does limiting their growth limit economic growth? And so I think those questions are somewhat related.
Yes, but I'll treat them as separate questions because they're easier to deal with. But Norman Baulog, I think, did enormous amount to make the world a better place. You know, he died recently. We mourn his death. He was an enormously important character in my thinking about the contemporary world. And I agree with him that that the means of producing more is within our reach. And people who are, it's not to say that there is no such possibility as overpopulation, but we are nowhere near that. And I think even though some people find it outrageous to think that he was not concerned so much with population, I think he was right to focus on the fact that much more agricultural products and food can be produced, and we are nowhere near the limits of what can be done. And he indeed did a lot for Green Revolution and so on to establish that. Where I might disagree a little with him is that he tended often to attribute all hunger to the amount of food that is produced and the commodities that that exist. Not always. He did recognize other issues that are there. But as it happens, which I found on the basis of my famine studies, that quite a lot of the famines, and very often almost half the famines occur in a situation where food availability isn't a problem. Sometimes it's a big problem, like it was in the Irish famines. But sometimes it's not, like it happened in the Bangladesh famine of 1974, where the food production was at its peak. So I think Norman Baulog might have been somewhat overemphatic in thinking about hunger arising only from the lack of food production. On the other hand, he was absolutely right to think that food production and hunger are related, and that food production can be dramatically increased. And it's much more sensible to concentrate on that rather than grumble all the time about overpopulation. I think the problem with the barrier to overpopulation really comes more from the third question, namely the climatic change rather than food deficit as such. And I think, if I may skip to the third question, I'll come to the second later, then I think the climatic problems are indeed very serious. We do need an agreement across the world. I think many countries have more to do. The United States should ratify these agreements. China and India, as new polluters, have to accept some restriction. That is, however, not unfair to the fact that they are very poor countries, and as such, they need to expand. And Europe and Americans have been expanding for 200 years, and China and India need more room, and Brazil and South Africa and so on. But then there's also the interest of other countries, mostly in Africa, which haven't started growing or polluting at all. And we don't want a situation where not only Europe and America overcrowd what we can call the global commons, but China and India and Brazil make it impossibly overcrowded. So there's a need for judgment. I think the direction in which the third question went, I've forgotten his or her name.
Phil.
Pardon?
Phil from Fort Collins, yeah, Colorado. Phil.
Phil's name. Well, I now remember his name, namely Phil. So, and I think what Phil is asking is that, does it mean that we are overexpanded? I don't think it really means that. But certainly there is a connection with production and effluent, clearly. And one would have to be stupid to deny that. On the other hand, the level of production, is not the same thing as the level of the effluents that happen. We happen to release in the atmosphere the pollution that we do. That depends on the nature of technology we use, the commodity bundles we use. In any case, throughout the world, we find that there has been a shift towards services away from commodity production. That's true in every country in the world. So services quite often, not invariably, but most often, they tax the global climate far less than commodity production does. So I think it's a question of also adjusting the composition of consumption, the composition of production, the nature of our technology. without forgetting that there is a connection between production and global climatic change, but not to take the view that we have just reached the limit. I think I have no sympathy for such views as the limits to growth thesis that the Club of Rome once put forward, because I think that's just simplistic thinking. On the other hand, is there a connection? Of course it's a connection. It's a sophisticated one, and with which we about which we can do something by looking at the composition of consumption and production. And well, finally, the corruption question. Do you have time for that or not?
Real briefly, because as you know, if I had my druthers, I'd keep you here for another 4 hours. But there are others who I can't make decisions for.
No. I think corruption is a very central issue. I think the two things. For a while, I used to advise the Italian government in what was called the Anti-Mafia Commission, because that was connection with mafia. But mafia, the reason it was very effective is through corruption. And one thing I learned is that not only that corruption is generated when there is huge incentive given by silly regulation for corruption, but also when the culture of corruption becomes accepted. Again and again, when you ask someone, why did you do it, the answer would be, well, everybody does it. Everybody takes bribes. Or if I didn't pay bribes, then I wouldn't be able to go ahead in business. So I think we are looking not so much only on individual morality, like what we might do, which is quite important, in a Sunday school, but it's a social morality. What is the nature of the culture which tolerates and encourages corruption? So I think that question is very important. And someday perhaps we will have a chance to chat again on that, but I recognize, given the nature of time, I have to say goodbye now. But I would like to thank you, Jack, and for inviting me, and like to thank all those who have been very kind in listening to me.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It has been such an honor and so interesting for me, and I know I can speak for everyone else the same. And do thank Laura for all of her work behind the scenes for making this happen.
I'll tell her that.
And thank you. And, you know, if you ever have the urge to talk to North Dakota again, we will bend over backwards to make it happen.
Oh, I'm proud of that very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you all for those of you who stayed with us and listened to the lightning round. And we hope to hear from you next month.